It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at legends and lore from haunted Wisconsin.
First, according to a new report from the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, citations issued by conservation wardens have fallen significantly at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in recent years.
The report finds that enforcement of all conservation violations declined 28% in the years 2011 to 2013 compared to 2003 to 2010. That includes an 85% drop in citations for hunting deer out of season, among other things. But why are these numbers way down?
Joining us now to talk about the report is George Meyer. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and a former DNR secretary. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, why is it worth taking a close look at why we're seeing a substantial difference in these numbers?
Well, I think it's important to, especially sportsmen and women, but basically they're all citizens that our state conservation and firearm issues laws are enforced. And it is of great concern to many sportsmen. In fact, there has been a drop off of enforcement recently. And we hope that the legislature and the governor and DNR senior management take steps to address the situation.
How big a drop do you see this 28% difference as being?
That is a very significant drop. We have a really an excellent conservation warden force, outstanding men and women that are doing the enforcement. But without a deterrent for illegal poaching and driving boats, operating boats without being intoxicated, road hunting and things like this, it will increase. The reason you have enforcement of our conservation and safety laws is to prevent improper practices from taking place. They are the only way to deter via this type of activity.
Now, how did you put this analysis together?
Well, we actually had the statistics from the Bureau of Law Enforcement to keep excellent detailed records each year of, I think they have 426 types of violations, and they keep a detailed record of the number of citations issued under each one of those violations. And then we just did the math, took the average of the years from 2003 to 2010, and got that average, and then compared the average of the last 3 years. And that's where it showed that for all the 426 classes, there was a there's a reduction of 28%. But in some of these areas, which are probably most important to citizens and in sportsmen and women, included, there are some really major differences. Deer shining, which is upsetting to any landowner, and of course sportsman, is down 44% as an example. Fishing without a license, violations are down 33%, and that provides the revenue for managing fish and wildlife in the state.
And what are some of the others? There's also, driving a boat while intoxicated?
So that one is down 33%. And then one that really gets at the fish habitat, and that is people changing the beds of lakes and digging up lakes or filling in lakes and shorelines, which are important for future fish and wildlife habitat. Those violations, citations, are down 62%.
Now, I guess one of the things that we're trying to get a handle on this is the big question is why this is going on. And there are different ideas out there about why it's happening. But why do you think you're seeing this difference?
Well, I think there's really three reasons are causing this. And, we do have excellent conservation wardens in the state, and they need the tools to get the job done. And, I think there has been a de-emphasis among administration towards enforcement. I know we've seen that in the environmental enforcement area in the state, and it appears to also be happening on conservation law enforcement. But also, there's been vacancies in the warden positions, and they need to be filled so we have adequate deterrence so that, for instance, if there's two wardens in a county and there's one vacancy, that means a warden has to cover a whole county in terms of their area. And then the third area is the money they have for operating, which is a lot of it is gas money for their vehicle. That has been reduced substantially over the last few years. So they can't get out and patrol areas where violations take place. And it makes it very difficult for them to do their job.
Now, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has framed this in political terms, comparing the years Governor Walker has been in office with his appointed secretary versus the years that Governor Doyle was in office, 2003 to 2010. Do you see this as a political finding?
Well, we are not a political organization. In fact, we stay away from it. We received these numbers this week, and that's why we put them out. If we got them next week, we would have put them out next week. But I think the reason what became very apparent when you look at the numbers, that there is a significant difference in the last 3 years and the past years. And we could have gone back another 10 years under Governor Thompson, who was a Republican, and the numbers would have been substantially lower from these 3 years than those numbers. So this isn't a partisan political issue. The numbers just are very striking over the last 3 years compared to any of the years prior to that.
And there's no connection with the pending election and the report, as you see it, as some are saying maybe there is a political motivation behind the release of these numbers now.
Not at all. These numbers, I understand, were asked for a long time ago, and we would have put out this report whenever we received the numbers. And if that were 6 months ago, we would have done it. If it's 6 months in the future, we would have done it. We received the numbers. They were being distributed, so we did our analysis and put it out this week.
The DNR has said that they see this as essentially good news that citations are down. It means that people are following the laws. They don't need to be issuing the citations. And they're saying it's pretty much the evidence that their education and outreach efforts have been working. What do you think of that?
Well, clearly we support educational efforts. And, you know, conservation warrants do play a major role. But it really strains credibility to think that over 426 different types of violations, there's been education done so that all of them were lowered. It clearly is less ability of wardens to do their job. Surely in some of these areas, education did play a role. There's no way that education reduced violations across 426 different, highly different categories of state conservation and public safety laws.
And what is the next step in your plan to get the DNR, the state legislature, the governor, whoever it might be, on board with increasing enforcement?
Well, you know, one reason to put this information out was, in fact, to educate the public that this is happening. Otherwise, these records would have sat in a computer and in DNR, and no one would have known. The idea is to provide knowledge and momentum for hopefully a change of emphasis at DNR, but also for more financial resources for the Conservation Warden Force to be able to fill vacancies and to have money to run their vehicles and do the other types of support activities that are important for them to enforce these laws. And we intend to bring this to the national legislature and try to get increased funds for state conservation wardens.
George, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and a former DNR secretary. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Halloween is tomorrow, and Wisconsin has its full share of ghost stories, and nobody knows them better than our next guest.
Michael Norman joins us now. He's Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin River Falls and the co-author of the book Haunted Wisconsin and Haunted Heartland, among other books on ghostly subjects. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what first got you interested in Wisconsin hauntings?
Well, my late co-author, Beth Scott, and I simply wanted to do a book. It's kind of a boring story. We wanted to do a nonfiction book about Wisconsin in our sort of research looking, what are we going to write about? We came across a comment by the late folklorist and author Robert Gard that, in his opinion, Wisconsin had more ghosts per square mile than any other state. I pointed this out to Beth, and I thought, well, if we could prove that some way, or maybe investigate this. No one had ever done a collection of ghost stories from Wisconsin. And if Boy Scout troops bought them to tell over campfires or Girl Scout troops, we might sell a few copies. So that's sort of how it began, with that interest. His interest was folklore, legendary yarns, he called them. And then we broadened that to include, contemporary stories. It's not enough to have a 100-year-old story. What about today?
As you started digging, did it seem like Wisconsin really was a ghost-rich environment?
Digging with no pun intended.
Right. No literal digging.
I don't know. We were never able to prove or disprove his comment, what he wrote. We did find about 67 stories that we included in the first edition 34 years ago, actually, in 1980. The third edition is out a few years ago from the University of Wisconsin Press. I think we found enough. Certainly within the last 20 years or so, there's been more interest in it.
Now, when you wrote Haunted Wisconsin back in 1980, you had never seen a ghost. Any change in your status since then?
I haven't seen a ghost. I had one auditory something that happened to me.
All right, what is it? You got to tell us.
Briefly, because it can get complicated. Briefly, I was doing a play at the campus theater in River Falls. And this theater is supposed to be haunted by the ghost of a professor who was a key in designing that theater. And he's been seen by a current theater professor there, actually. And I was doing a show before a summer stock season, and I was on stage with an actress doing a two-person show, when from backstage I heard someone strum a ukulele. And the ukulele was on the prop table backstage, and there was no one backstage. We had just been out there for intermission, or back there for intermission. No one was there, and yet I heard distinctly what sounded like someone strumming a ukulele, which is a unique sound. I would have, when the show ended, I ran backstage to look around. Again, doors were locked. And I would have dismissed it if the house manager, who was standing at the back of the theater, and the stage manager, who was in the light booth listening to us on his headphones, both came up to me after the show and wondered who made that ukulele strum coming from backstage. They heard it, one at the back of the theater and then one over headphones. The three of us were never able to figure out what it was. And I still can't to this day.
Well, you mentioned the older stories versus the newer ones. And if you think back to the 19th century, most of us are in candle or lantern light, walking at night. It maybe was a more ripe time for potential ghost sightings. Do we have too much technology, too much distraction around us to spot these things these days?
Oh, boy, I don't think so.
No.
Not if you judge all the... I think there are cable channels that are just stocked with ghost hunters and hauntings and all kinds of series. You can spend evenings binging on these kinds of shows. So I don't think so. I think with some of the folklore, the Ridgeway Ghost, probably the most famous ghost in folklore in Wisconsin from southwest part of the state, that was certainly 19th century because you were traveling at night with a lantern held high or nothing, just trying to get by from the moonshine. And so you could believe. You didn't really know what was out there. People were superstitious. We didn't know what we know today about science. But even today now, there's been no scientific evidence that the paranormal exists. It hasn't occurred. And yet, consistently, anywhere from a third to almost a half of people surveyed in this country believe that there can be ghosts or hauntings. And you hear enough anecdotal evidence or anecdotal sort of stories from people that you trust. They say, I'm not so sure. Wait a minute, let me tell you what happened in that apartment I was living in, over on State Street. And then they tell you, they might add, well, now that doesn't mean I don't believe in ghosts, but, it happened to me, honestly. So I don't think so. And I think the technology, especially with these television shows, in which they bring in all kinds of blinking lights and meters, and I have no idea what they all are. It seems like, ripe pickings today.
You talked about the Ridgway ghost as being one of the most famous, and that's what we've talked about on the show before. Are there other less well-known Wisconsin ghost stories?
Well, I'd like to think that all of the ones in Haunted Wisconsin are probably less well-known because not everyone has read them.
You want to pick one of your favorites?
Oh, boy. That's hard. There's another very well-known one in Vilas County called Summer Wind about a mansion that was said to have changed shape and burned down about 20 years ago. I did a new version of that in the current edition of Haunted Wisconsin. I think that's relatively well known. There are others. There's some restaurants that are haunted. It's hard to pick out one. We were talking before the show about the ghost stories at River Falls, where I was, and that in the university center they've even painted a mural with a ghost peeking out of a window in a building on campus that's no longer there. That had a ghost legend, ghost story connected with it.
What was that legend? I was up there and I remember hearing it, and I've forgotten it now, I'm afraid to say. So it wasn't the same ghost that played the ukulele in the theater. This is a different ghost,
well,
right?
It could have been. Uh-huh. Yeah, it could have been traveling between the buildings. You never know. This story dealt with a custodian on campus. And again, that's one of the things that I really enjoy, finding good, solid sources who have a specific incident, and they'll say, let me tell you, this was a custodian, and I had heard about the experience she had in this building the day after it occurred from the director of custodial activities on campus, who sort of came running up to me as I walked into my office building, the building where my office was, and he said, Mike, you have to talk to so-and-so. She had a really, really strange experience yesterday in the old lab school, in the gymnasium. I didn't get around to it for a time, interviewed her, and essentially she was sitting in her small little custodial office on the first floor, and below it, this is an old laboratory school, there was a gymnasium, and from her, in her little custodial office, she heard a basketball dribbling on the court, below her. And she had locked the door not long before. Hmm. And she said, well, who got in? So she got up, walked down the steps, toward the gym, opened the door. It was open. Opened it up, and she saw several basketball players kind of murky in the distance below one of the nets in old fashioned baggy sort of 1930s 40s basketball uniforms dribbling, and as one of these whatever went up for a layup, the whole scene disappeared.
Wow.
Whole scene vanished. She shut the door, went back upstairs and sat there for the rest of the time. Very strange story.
My goodness, ghost basketball.
Ghost basketball, And
I like the idea that ghosts want to play basketball. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, are there malevolent ones? Because ukuleles and basketballs, I'm okay with my ghost doing that. Are there ones where they seem to mean us harm?
Well, there are. I was talking about Summer Wind and women especially who went into that house over the years and even today claim that when they're in the area, there's a feeling of malevolence, toward them more so. There's one story that's too long to go into with the time we have left, but several young women who had gone in to work a Ouija board at night when it still stood had a very eerie experience. The ghost stories, the ones that you have to keep track of or you want to base on true information. The malevolence or the fear generally is comes from the person experiencing it. My view is that if something sounds too malevolent to be true, it probably isn't true. It's another Amityville horror kind of thing where someone said, well, let's take this and this and this and put it together.
And then we've got a story to tell.
We've got a book to write or TV show to do or whatever.
Well, Michael, we leave it there. So many hauntings, it sounds like, to investigate in Wisconsin. Appreciate you coming on and sharing a few of them with us.
Thank you.
That was Michael Norman, Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, the co-author of the book Haunted Wisconsin and also Haunted Heartland.
Well, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some more Halloween coverage. I will talk to World War Z author Max Brooks about the role of horror today and what happens when vampires encounter zombies. We'll also get a look at great horror films over the years and maybe hear some of your favorites along the way.
On Food Friday, we'll talk to a chef who's drawing recipes, ingredients, and inspiration from his Native American heritage.
And we'll check out the top Wisconsin news stories of the week, including the latest news in the countdown to Election Day. And by the way, as you're counting down, head over to wisconsinvote.org for all your election information needs.
Stay tuned. A lot coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Still to come today, we explore Lake Michigan with a photographer who traveled over 1,800 miles to capture the faces of the people who live and work and play on the Great Lake. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look back at 40 years of the popular PBS music series Austin City Limits.
First, 2 years ago, photographer Kevin Miyazaki set off on a trip around Lake Michigan to find out who the people were that lived, worked, and played on the Great Lake.
Miyazaki drove over 1,800 miles with a portable photo booth that he set up on the lake's beaches and parks and even on boat docks and backyards. His goal to find out what connected people to Lake Michigan.
Well, photographing a wide range of people from residents and scientists to dock workers and surfers, he also asked them to share their thoughts about Lake Michigan. What did the lake mean to them, and why do they care about it?
Kevin Miyazaki is with us now. He's a Milwaukee-based editorial and fine art photographer. His work has appeared in Martha Stewart Living, Travel and Leisure, and the New York Times Magazine. His latest book is Perimeter, a Contemporary Portrait of Lake Michigan. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Well, why did you decide to highlight the voices and stories of the people who live alongside and who love Lake Michigan?
Well, the project was originally a commission by the Hagerty Museum of Art, which is at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And the Hagerty came to me and asked me to do a project that addresses the Great Lakes and freshwater. They wanted to participate in this ongoing discussion that's happening here in Milwaukee and in the region about freshwater and the importance of freshwater research. And so left it pretty open-ended. They said it should address the Great Lakes somehow, and it would be a photographic exhibition at the museum in 2013. And so I had been making these series of portraits for a while, people against a really simple black backdrop. And what that does is it really sort of isolates the individual, sort of celebrates the individual. Then when the photographs are exhibited in a group, it has this really kind of powerful aspect of community. So in thinking about the Great Lakes, I actually thought I wanted to make pictures of people and make a series of these portraits using a portable photo booth. And so it led to a 13-day drive around the lake in the summer of 2012, in which I photographed nearly 300 people for the project.
What were those days like when you were driving along Lake Michigan? How did you pick your route and meet people?
They were long days. I decided to stay off of the interstate highway. So I drove the entire way, just always trying to find the lake. I went counterclockwise, so I basically made this kind of beautiful big left-hand turn around Lake Michigan. But I just kept looking for the water. It was also a bit of an investigation of access, trying to see where I could find the water and what prevented me from finding the water in some cases, industry and sort of wealthier areas where it wasn't as accessible. But I just kept looking for the water, and the people I found, I would stop and photograph, sometimes just one person. Sometimes I would set up for several hours and wait for people to come by me.
And how did you approach these people who were living and working and playing near the lake?
I just asked people if I could take their picture. I had some examples. I had photographed some people before I left Milwaukee. And so I had some example pictures, and I had a statement and on a little postcard. So I just gave people the postcard and asked if they'd sit for me. It really only took a few minutes with each subject, so it wasn't sort of a big time commitment for them. And overwhelmingly, people said yes. There were only very few people out of the hundreds that I approached that actually said no.
Now, you are from Milwaukee. You live in close proximity to Lake Michigan. What is your connection with the lake?
Yeah, I grew up in Wauwatosa, so in the suburbs, really close to Lake Michigan physically. But I think my lifelong relationship with the lake has been maybe similar to most people that grew up here, where it's not a daily occurrence for me to see Lake Michigan. I don't think about it all the time, but I realize its importance. It's a compass for me. I think anyone who lives in proximity of the water like this, it sort of is a navigational, geographical compass for us. I know which direction the lake is. If I'm looking out the studio window here in Milwaukee right now, I know which direction the lake is, or if I'm driving on one of the highways or something. So it's always been sort of a grounding element for me, but I don't know that before this project I looked at it that closely, to be honest with you.
Now, when you talk to these people and took their photographs, you have got what their connection to the lake is and what they think is, important for the lake going forward. And it's interesting about the themes that emerge. There's a lot of commonality there. And one is that people seem really captivated by the changing face of Lake Michigan. And they describe it as having all these different moods, almost like a person.
It does. The idea for the project was really a portrait project, but I knew I would photograph the lake as I went. Again, it's sort of this record and this investigation of access. So whenever I found the water, I would make simple pictures of the lake. And in the book, the lake pictures are in chronological order of the trip. But I knew it would be interesting because the colors and the face of the lake, as you said, would change. But I actually didn't realize how much that would be evident. And so when I was through with the trip and I had these pictures of the lake itself, hundreds of them, I realized that the complexity of the colors and the light and the water was just pretty amazing. And so those pictures actually became part of the exhibition at the Hegarty as well.
Well, let's dive into some of the stories that you got to hear about people's connection with the lake. There is a Native American leader named Frank Etowagashik who talked about his connection. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Frank was terrific. I met him via email before my trip. In research for the trip, I was reaching out to people and trying to find subjects that I could connect with along the way. And Frank and I struck up a friendship via email, and I met him in Harbor Springs, Michigan. And I photographed him down near the water in a little tiny park in Harbor Springs, this kind of beautiful little town. And we were talking about the history of the water and his connection to the lake and his family. And then all of a sudden, sort of out of the blue, Frank began singing the Native American water song for me in this little tiny park with people walking by. And he had quite a beautiful, booming voice. And it was this really, it was a really special moment in the trip. It was about halfway. I was kind of exhausted. And it was this really kind of enlightening, very calming occurrence that happened to me. And it was terrific.
What did he say about what was precious to him about Lake Michigan?
He talked about the complexity of the water, but its connections to both his ancestors and his descendants. I actually have a quote by Frank that I could read if you like.
Sure.
Frank says, so I asked the subjects, by the way, their thoughts about the lake. I really didn't have time when I was photographing people to take down notes necessarily. The process was pretty quick with each subject. But I gathered their information and I asked them to email me thoughts about the lake. So the quotes that I gathered were really after the fact, which I think also made for, it gave people time to actually think and compose their thoughts more. But this is what Frank said in part. Its power is centered during calm and storm. Its long reach is both to my ancestors and my descendants. It's been terrifying and comforting all at the same time. Its beauty mystifies and inspires every time I come upon it. And I think, a lot of people that wrote about the lake talk about this aspect of how the water sort of centers them, and it's this grounding, calming effect. And Frank described, I think, both.
Right. People talked about it as almost a therapist.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually subjects called the Point Swimmers, this group of women in Chicago that swim most mornings when the weather permits on the lake in Hyde Park in Chicago. And one of the women called the lake her therapist. Absolutely.
Another theme that emerged throughout all of these conversations you had and these pictures, this process, was the theme of conservation of Lake Michigan. How did people talk about their worries for the future of the lake?
You know, I photographed a fair amount of people from the environmental community, particularly in the Traverse City area of Michigan. I was telling somebody recently, after this trip, I mean, I spent a lot of time on the lake and looking at the lake and talking to people. I don't know that I'm a better expert on the lake from before my trip, and I don't know that I know deeply all the environmental concerns that address the lake, but I met all these people that care so deeply about it and that are working towards it. I think most of the people I met were very hopeful about it. I didn't photograph that many people in a large industry, but I photographed more sort of grassroots environmental people who had positive and sort of energetic ideas about the future.
Were people thinking about the next generation and wanting the lake as it is today or maybe even in a better state to be passed on to their children, their grandchildren, the next generations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very diverse group of people that I photographed, and the end of the book actually is a pairing of two portraits, and one is a woman who is 81 that I photographed who was a volunteer in Gulliver, Michigan at the lighthouse. And then the last picture, the portrait in the book, is a young boy named Davis Chang, an Asian American boy who I photographed in a park in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And to me, that was sort of a representation of this generation passing, right? The woman, Naomi, from the lighthouse had volunteered there for many years. And it was something that was very close to her. And this young boy, Davis, who was, you know, just having a fun day with his family in the park, to me that represented the handoff, maybe, or the changing in the generations. And so much faces the lake, as we know, in the future.
We're exploring Lake Michigan right now, looking at the faces of the people who have a connection to this great lake and their stories and that connection that they have. We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you live near or on Lake Michigan, or do you love to spend time there? What draws you to it? What's special to you, and what matters most to you when you think about the lake and its future? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about Lake Michigan and the many diverse people who have a strong connection with that great lake.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a special place in your heart for Lake Michigan or any of our great lakes? What is your connection to the lake? And do you have a favorite memory of time spent on or near the lake with your family, friends, on the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We continue our exploration of the lake with Milwaukee-based photographer Kevin Miyazaki. His latest book is Perimeter, a Contemporary Portrait of Lake Michigan. And Kevin, there was another person that you spoke with, a young woman who had spent a lot of time alone on Lake Michigan, and her name was Jen Gibbons. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, Jen is this amazing woman who rowed a boat by herself around Lake Michigan the same summer that I was actually on my trip as well. She just recently biked the entire perimeter also of the lake. But she's this really interesting Chicago-based woman who has founded an organization called Row Recovery on Water, and it's for breast cancer survivors. With the idea that the training and the physical exercise is really great in recovery. But she made a solo journey around the lake in one of these sort of large rowboats that you see that they cross the Atlantic on. They're sort of a capsule where you can sleep inside the boat and whatnot. So she was on her own sort of perimeter trip and was posting a lot to social media as a way for her fundraisers and to raise money for the cause. The sad part of the story is that when she was in the Upper Peninsula area at night, sleeping on her boat, she was attacked. And she recovered from that and continued her trip. So it was this pretty amazing story. She's a really, really incredibly kind of inspirational and strong woman. And so we had been in contact before the trip, but we actually photographed her after she made the complete journey around the lake.
And what did she say about her connection after all that she had been through and experienced?
Yeah, I mean, she's somebody who grew up near the water and you know, it was one of these experiences where she worked so hard. It was like this all-encompassing physical trip to row the waters by herself. And I think it was a powerful experience for her. I don't have her quote in front of me, but I can find it if we...
That's okay. We can also go ahead and take a couple of the people who want to talk to you right now. Laura is joining us right now from Grand Marsh. Hey, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to say one thing. I grew up around Lake Michigan, but my family, we would picnic on the parks in Grand Park and South Milwaukee and everything like that. But I never really saw Lake Michigan until one day when it was below zero and I was in my office. On top of one of the office buildings in Milwaukee. And it was below zero weather, and I just couldn't believe it. It was like a fairyland. The lake just exuded this vapor, the cloud. It was like as if I was flying above the clouds, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And so I had never seen Lake Michigan like that in 25 years, and it was just marvelous. If nobody's ever seen the lake like that in the middle of winter, they've never really seen the lake.
Wow. Well, thank you, Laura, for sharing that. She says it's like a fairyland. And again, another one of these moods of the lake that you might be lucky enough to catch.
Absolutely. I just gave a talk in Sheboygan, and one of the people asked if I would do the same trip in the winter, which I think would be really beautiful. It would be... I'd probably find a lot less people, but would be a beautiful way to look at the water.
Well, thanks for that call. And you can join us with your favorite Lake Michigan story, your most iconic moment of connecting with that great lake at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we go next to Tom joining us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. I believe I might have a photo in that book. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hi, Tom. Is this Tom Castle?
Yeah, sure is.
How are you?
Good. I was just calling in to say the first time I grew up in Chicago, and it was a place that no one ever told us while we were growing up that Chicago had 200 or 300 tall ships coming in every day during the 1870s and 1880s. As a part of my history, I never understood. And then I went sailing on the lake one time, and basically you turn the key to the engine off, and the wind just takes you across the lake, and it was just a magical feeling. It never goes away. It's always an amazing thing. And the thing about a lot of people don't understand about the lakes is they don't just go out to see it. I was doing library programs in Chicago. I went to 41 libraries, and we were doing shows for kids. Out of the Chicago Maritime Festival, and they basically between 10% and 80% of all the kids who came to those libraries had never seen Lake Michigan, even though they lived in Chicago.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think people just get themselves isolated into their own little neighborhoods and their own little worlds, and they are a little afraid sometimes to come out and go exploring. And for me, it was always the opposite. I want to go out and, you know, see more and travel more. But it was a trend that was across all socioeconomic bends and races and neighborhoods, and it really didn't matter. There was a significant part of the population of kids from anywhere from 4 years old to 14 years old who had never seen the lake.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Tom, and sharing some of those insights there. And he had some experience on tall ships. And you speak with other people in the book alongside Tom who did connect with the lake through those tall ship experiences, including the Dennis Sullivan, I think, out of Port Washington.
Absolutely. I met Tom and a group of crew members when the Dennis Sullivan and the Madeline, which is based in Traverse City, Michigan, were both docked in Port Washington. Tom's a great musician and a captain, so he kind of has these unique roles. But I met and photographed a good group of crew members from both of the boats, and many of those pictures are in the book.
Well, thank you to Tom. And we're going to go next to Laura joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I wanted to talk briefly about a memory that I hold in my heart, and I'm hoping that sometime soon I can go back again to the bluffs of the state of Michigan. Just across from the Manitou Islands, and I used to sit in the trees on the bluff watching the storms evolve over Lake Michigan, and the drama and the rain and the height and the wonderful, like, almost fear that you felt as it approached you closer and closer as it mounted up. And then it would drift into this valley below us, and we would watch it pour itself out. It still is just really a delight. It's at a camp that used to be called Camp Innisfree, and I think now it's a Christian Science camp. But it's just a really great place. And so to this day, I go down to Lake Michigan whenever stress gets really big, and I sit on one of the wonderful benches that they provided and just watch the waves roll in. And it's a definite beautiful place to meditate and relax and come back to being in step with yourself. So I think Michigan is really a healing and exciting place.
Laura, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Laura's not alone in talking about, well, first of all, the healing of Lake Michigan, but also the joy of watching storms over the lake. Were you lucky enough, Kevin, to see a storm?
I did. I saw some, and the pictures in the book sort of reflect this diversity of the water scenes that I saw. But I was mostly lucky to not see too many storms. I had 13 days of photographing, and I just had one day of rain. So I was pretty lucky that it didn't hamper my picture making very much.
Well, thanks a lot to Laura for the call. And let's go next to Bill in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Bill. Bill, you there?
Yes, I am.
What did you want to share?
I was just saying that I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, right across the street from Lake Michigan. And, I don't live there now, but I make it a point every time I get to that area to go to the same place that I was, you know, that I grew up in, and sit on the beach down there, and that's when I know I'm home. And it was a wonderful place to grow up, even though the shoreline down there has changed dramatically. But it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to grow up, and many fond memories there, friends and things. So that's about it.
Okay, thank you, Bill. And Bill, talking about the lake as being home, did you hear that from other people?
I did. You know, I photographed people that actually have the good fortune to live right on the lake. And then I photographed people that had come to this area from other places and were, I think, you know, the people that haven't seen the Great Lakes before, it's always a shock to them how large and how beautiful they are. One of the subjects, Zilke Kohl, who I photographed, was German. And she said when her parents were visiting and first saw Lake Michigan, they said, "This isn't a lake, this is an inland sea." So I think the drama maybe is lost on us sometimes if we take it for granted, but for people from other places who've seen it for the first time, it can be pretty powerful.
And Kevin, as we wrap up here, now that you've done this project, do you think you'll see the lake with different eyes?
I do. I'm hoping to see more of it. Again, kind of promoting this book, I'm doing talks, and so I'm actually on the lake more than I have been in a while. I'll be in Traverse City in a couple weeks again, which I'm looking forward to. I do. I have more of an appreciation for it just by the sort of human connection and the people that I met that love the water so much and care about it. I think it made an impact on me, certainly.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Miyazaki, Milwaukee-based photographer, whose latest book is called Perimeter, a contemporary portrait of Lake Michigan.
Still ahead here on Central Time, we'll explore the rich history of the popular public television music series Austin City Limits. It's marking 40 years on the air. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.